house is going up in flames.
Oh, my gosh. A horrifying red glow that was redder than anything I'd ever seen in my life. Brilliant and menacing beyond description.
It is completely on fire. Please pray for everybody.
To be okay,
we'll get through this.
To be okay.
All right.
Terrifying scenes of escape played out across California as wildfires ripped through the state. More than 30 people have been killed, some found in their cars, as they tried to flee the infernos. The campfire completely ravaged the town of Paradise in rural northeastern California. And down in Southern California, the Woolsey Fire and Hill Fires have forced more than 150,000 people to evacuate around Malibu and Calabasas, just north of Los Angeles.
My wife hasn't even been over to the site yet to see that ruin. She's just not quite ready for that.
We got to work and they said that the fire's almost here. Everybody got to go home. And then the police came up through the driveway and told everybody to evacuate.
I mean, it feels terrible for everybody. You know, we've all been through this, or many of us have been through this, and it's a gut-wrenching experience. You just feel raw and hopeful that the fire departments have been able, you know, to be successful, and they have in the past, and my hat's off to them because they're amazing people. Makes me cry.
Governor Jerry Brown addressed the state yesterday and again made the connection between these devastating fires and climate change.
This is not the new normal. This is the new abnormal. And unfortunately, the best science is telling us that dryness, warmth, drought, all those things, they're going to intensify.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And we begin today in the Golden State, turned red and gray with fire and smoke. Jenny Hamill is a reporter with KCRW, and she joins me now. Hi, Jenny.
Hi there.
We also have William Stewart, a forestry specialist and co-director of Berkeley Forest at the University of California, Berkeley. William, thanks for being with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Jenny, I want to start with you. We saw two major fires erupt just over the past couple of days. Tell us where these fires are burning and what's the extent of the destruction so far.
So here in Southern California, we have been covering the Woolsey and the Hill Fire. The Woolsey Fire, much bigger at this point, estimated at about 85,000 acres. It really exploded over the weekend, especially on Friday, from several thousand up to 74,000, really driven by the Santa Ana winds coming in from the desert, hot, dry, moving fast, at some points 50 to 60, 70 mile hour per hour gusts. It has destroyed approximately 177 homes. It's 15% contained. At one point, there was a lull in the winds, and that really helped firefighters start to establish some perimeter control around the fire. And although the winds picked up a little bit yesterday, firefighters say they have been able to hold those lines. There have been two fatalities, although it's not confirmed that they're from the fires. There were two bodies found in Malibu in a vehicle. So certainly the Woolsey Fire has caused absolute havoc on people living in Los Angeles and Ventura counties. And then as we look to the north, the Camp Fire, there's about 4,000 firefighters fighting what they are now calling the most destructive fire in state history. We've got 29 fatalities. It's tied with a fire that occurred in Los Angeles in the early 30s. And as you mentioned, many of those in the town of Paradise. This is a small town of about 26,000 sitting in the Sierra Nevada foothills. It's estimated that 80 to 90% of those buildings have been destroyed. And they say that many of those people died in their cars trying to flee the flames.
Those were horrifying images that we saw over the weekend on social media and also that people were posting of just trying to get out. William, I want to bring you in here to respond to Jenny. In terms of the size of this and the destruction of these fires, around this time last year, the Tubbs Fire in Northern Cal had taken the title of the most destructive fire. But now the Camp Fire in California, as Jenny mentioned, seems to be taking that title now. Are there any similarities that we can draw from the two fires, William?
Yeah, I think the biggest similarity is that these fires are being driven, just like the fires in Southern California, by very high wind events. And by this time of year in California, pretty much all the fuel is dry. And as long as you have a warm weekend, it can go quickly. But it's really these really big wind events that drive them basically faster than the fire services can can do to slow them down, at least. And the Paradise Fire, the campfire, most of the damage happened on the first day when the fire totally burned over the town of Paradise. So it's when these flames go really quickly and they grow on the first day before the thousands of firefighters come, that's the most, the riskiest time. And that's both the Tubbs fire and this fire that burned down Paradise. Most of the fatalities and the action happened in the first 12 hours.
Jenny, we mentioned the reaction and some of the horrifying images that were coming out of social media. But another thing we saw were lots of celebrities, obviously, talking about getting, you know, their taking care of their homes, et cetera. And of course, this is because Malibu has a reputation for being a wealthier part of the state. But you also talked to people who weren't celebrities, who weren't as wealthy, including someone named Rachel Robert Stoker, who had to evacuate from her home in Malibu. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
More people started to arrive. People with horses started to arrive. More people started to arrive. More animals started arriving. They started setting up corrals on the sand, which was just such a wild, wild sight. I never imagined I would ever experience anything like that.
Jenny, give us a sense of Rachel and some of the other folks you talked to.
Yeah, so Rachel Robert Stoker, she's a resident of Paradise Cove. That is a mobile home park that sits right next to the ocean, just to the west of the Pacific Coast Highway. There's about 270 trailers, although very nice trailers that sit right on the ocean. She says it's a really tight-knit community that includes a lot of retirees, retired firefighters, artists, surfers, people who want to live near the ocean but don't want to pay those Malibu prices for those mega mansions. So she was actually talking about the fact that a lot of the residents in Malibu decided to stay in Malibu, although there were mandatory evacuation orders. They all kind of ended up at the Zuma Beach parking lot and stayed there for days until I think ultimately they were finally kicked out by officials. And she was referring to many people who live inland in Malibu, keep ranches, have horses and animals. And she said that essentially it was a very surreal experience to not only have many of her neighbors, you know, camped out at this parking lot, but also to see all the animals coming as well.
And William, I want to ask you, because we've seen, I mean, we just mentioned at the top of the segment, there are fire after fire after fire in California. Each one of these fires is equally, if not more, destructive than the last. And I wonder two things. What's really spurring this? Is it a question of land planning? Or is this, would like to bring in what the president said this over the weekend, that this is something, you know, this is an issue about poor forest management. What's really happening here?
Well, I think that this fire here is, there is actually a fire right near Paradise in 2008, only 10 years ago, that pretty much burned out most of the fuel where this fire started. So that we already had essentially a fuel break there, but just these high winds coming this late in the season, there just essentially is nothing that can stop it. This is a scale of a San Andreas level earthquake. There's just, you can do all the preparation you want, but when the winds are coming 50 mile an hour, if there's anything more vegetation than a parking lot, it's gonna catch on fire. So this really wasn't a question of poor forest management. It was just this is just such severe fire weather in this case.
And Jenny, you talked to Paul Major, who's another Malibu resident. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
We got friends that will put us up for a few weeks or as long as we need to, a year or so. We'll see how long it takes to get permits, and I don't know if insurance is even covered. Portions of the house. I mean, we're all insured things, but it's never enough or right, probably.
Jenny, what do residents like Paul, what do they have to expect in these upcoming days in terms of cleanup and relocating if needed?
Well, you've got to realize that for people like Paul, I mean, his area is still under a mandatory evacuation order. So although you do have insurance companies that have set up mobile offices outside of the major burn zones so they can start helping people who've lost homes start processing claims or property claims, right now, I think fire officials are very much concerned with, you know, save lives first, structures later, and then deal with the rebuilding process. So of the people that are reporting, reporting staff has talked to many people who have lost homes or are waiting to see if their home survived are kind of in a holding pattern. They're staying with friends and family throughout Los Angeles, Ventura counties, and waiting to see what the ultimate result is and then, you know, what the steps are moving forward. But, you know, as Paul expressed, there's major uncertainty about whether you can rebuild to the point where the home looks as it once was and all of your valuables are intact. So, you know, it's a very uncertain time. time for these people.
And of course, Jenny, we know that, as we mentioned, that these fires almost feel unstoppable and so frequent at this point. Does the state of California have the resources to fight fires at this level? I know that they're using, in addition to firefighters, they're also tapping into inmates at certain correctional facilities to fight these fires. Can you give us a sense of who and whether or not the state actually has the capacity?
Yeah, that is something that is talked about every time we have one of these major fire events in California, especially with, as Governor Brown said, this being the new normal. Firefighters in California spread especially thin. You know, we had a gamut of fires that occurred in July. So with 4,000 firefighters up in the Camp Fire and several thousand more down here, that has been the narrative, that firefighters are spread thin. Firefighters are coming in from other states. And certainly we are topping out our resources, as you can expect.
I'm also wondering, in terms of, you know, William, I want to pivot to you here for a second. What else do we need to be talking about when we're talking about these fires? Admittedly, winds are not helping, but we've also talked about the man and woman power that goes into fighting these fires. What about the climate element of this? How much is climate related?
Well, we're clearly seeing, we've been looking at the trends over the last 50 years, and there's just an increase in the area burned by fires every decade since the 70s. So there's clearly a fairly large fingerprint of climate change here. And also, just a little bit of warming, it may only be a few degrees warmer, but that often helps make the winds much worse. So there's unquestionably the conditions in the last, especially in the last decade, where we seem to have broken a record every year, clearly shows we are moving into a period where we're going to have what we used to consider extreme events every year somewhere in the state. And that's really very concerning to everybody who's watching this, and especially all the residents of California.
And Jenny, has there been any indication of more help coming into the state of California from either other states or even beyond?
Yeah, certainly. There has been help nationwide with firefighters coming into California, you know, and certainly they can use as much help as they can get. The Santa Ana winds expected to pick up even more today. So firefighters bracing for that, hoping that their containment lines hold with the progress that they made this Saturday and in Sunday.
Jenny Hamill is a reporter with KCRW. Jenny, thanks for your reporting.
Thank you.
And William Stewart is a forestry specialist and co-director of Berkeley Forest at the University of California, Berkeley. William, thanks for your insights.
Thank you.
Is this person a citizen of the United States?
That's the question the Commerce Department wants to add to the 2020 U.S. Census. And a slew of states, cities, and groups are doing everything they can to keep that from happening.
Is this person a citizen of the United States?
In New York Federal District Court, the first legal challenge to that question is now entering its second week. The state of New York, along with more than a dozen other states and cities, is suing the Commerce Department, arguing that the citizenship question was improperly added to the census. One major question at the heart of the trial, how much would the citizenship question deter immigrant communities from participating in the census?
Is this person a citizen of the United States?
Hansi Lo Wang has been covering the trial and the fight over this question. He's NPR's national correspondent on the 2020 census. Hi, Hansi.
Hi, Tanzina.
Well, it's exciting. Never thought the census would be this exciting, but we are entering week two of the trial. Can you give us a sense of what happened in court last week?
It's really interesting. I've sat through every day, and basically, if you're in the courtroom, you're having essentially a public seminar on how the census works and on survey methodology and survey methodology and statistics. And these plaintiffs in these lawsuits, more than two dozen states and cities, as well as other groups, they're trying to make a case, as you said, that the decision, which was made by Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, he oversees the Census Bureau, and he decided to add this question on the census. The plaintiffs are trying to make an argument that he did that improperly and did it in a way that intentionally discriminated against immigrant communities of color.
Now, when you say he did that improperly, what is the proper procedure? Because I know, you know, the Census 2020 in particular is something that's been really hotly contested, with many different types of questions being asked about its methodology. So what's the right way to do something like this?
That's a really good question. And part of the reason why it's hard to answer that is because as Census Bureau, former Census Bureau directors and other experts have testified during this trial and their depositions, technically speaking, there is no set way for how questions are added to the what is known as the decennial census, the census that goes out every 10 years to every household in the country. It's not specified, the policy. However, there are lots of sets of policies about how federal surveys should be revised and the testing process. Generally speaking, there's a extensive process of testing in the field. You know, these are very, very sensitive tools, these surveys that the Census Bureau uses, and they really, really emphasize that just a slight change in the wording or even the order of the questions can have a big impact on the quality and the accuracy of the information they collect from people around the country, which is really important information. So the Trump administration is arguing in part that there is no set policy for census questions. Plaintiffs push back and say there is generally policy for other surveys in general that the federal government conducts. And they pointed to a number of former Census Bureau directors who say this was not the right way to do it.
Well, and what are the plaintiffs trying to prove through the witnesses that they've called so far at the trial?
They're trying to prove that this, again, didn't follow the right policy. And that one part of that is that the Census Bureau actually came back to the Justice Department, which formally set out this request for a citizenship question back in December 2017. And the Census Bureau came back to the Justice Department and said, we received your request. We figured out a better way of collecting citizenship information to help you, Justice Department, better enforce the Voting Rights Act, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, protections against discrimination of racial and language minorities. We think, the Census Bureau said, we think we have a better way that you don't need to add a question. We can actually compile existing government records on citizenship. And by doing it that way, it gives you more accurate data and also costs less money. Let's meet and talk about it, Justice Department, Census Bureau researchers said. The Justice Department did not meet with the Census Bureau. I learned recently through court filings that former U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions directed the Justice Department not to meet with the Census Bureau to discuss these alternatives. And that's one big point the plaintiffs are emphasizing here. That's one big part of the process, generally speaking, a kind of a discussion between agencies to better figure out what's the best way to collect data. That didn't happen. They're also pointing to a number of statements made by President Trump, as well as other Trump administration officials that disparage immigrant communities. And they're pointing to that as evidence, as potentially evidence that this is an act that intentionally discriminated against immigrant communities of color, because Census Bureau research suggests that putting a question about citizenship status on the census is particularly discouraging, will scare off households with non-citizens and really make it that much harder for the Census Bureau to count every person living in the country.
And this trial is expected to last about 2 weeks, but what are we looking for as this begins to wrap up? Are there any other legal challenges against the census or the specific citizenship question?
Well, there are 6 lawsuits around the country in total over the citizenship question. I've been tracking so there's 2 here in New York. There's also 2 in California. There's 2 in Maryland. Just on late Friday, a federal judge in Maryland said that one of the cases in Maryland can go forward. The Trump administration tried to get it tossed out of court. So that was a 6th attempt by the Trump administration to get lawsuits over the citizenship question tossed out of the court. They lost again. And so right now we're waiting to see exactly how the California and Maryland cases turn out. There's a trial here in New York, but we're not sure if there's going to be trials out in California as well as Maryland. And once all of these cases at the district court level get sorted out and we have rulings from the judges, then it's expected that all of these rulings get appealed through the circuit courts and then ultimately the Supreme Court.
There are a couple of other questions I know outstanding, and very briefly, we've got about 30 seconds left, but there's also questions about Hispanics, how they're going to answer the census, and the MENA category as well. Has there been any movement on those, Middle Eastern, North African communities, and Hispanic communities?
So far, the White House's Office of Management and Budget, which is in charge of those standards that the Census Bureau has to follow, they have not issued any guidance on these proposals to change the race ethnicity categories that allow for a new category for people of Middle Eastern and North African descent and changing how Hispanic or Latino origin information is collected. And so it is basically essentially a status quo from what we saw in 2010, except that under the boxes for white and black, if you check off those boxes for the first time, the U.S. Census Bureau is going to ask you to write in your origins.
Fascinating stuff. Hansi Lo Wong is NPR's national correspondent on the 2020 census. Hansi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Support for this podcast comes from Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel language learning app. And you can too. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. Babbel users say they're amazed at how fast they learned and that they are confident in speaking their new language. Start learning a new language today. Just go to babbel.com and use offer code TAKEAWAY to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Babbel, BABBEL.com, offer code TAKEAWAY for 50% off your first 3 months.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And on Sunday, Americans marked Veterans Day, while across the Atlantic, world leaders gathered in London and Paris to mark the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day, or the end of World War I. At a ceremony on Sunday, French President Emmanuel Macron had some tough words for the current nationalist sentiment sweeping the West. Here he is through a translator.
Patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism. Nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism. By saying, our interests first, who cares about the others? We erase what a nation holds dearest, what gives it life, what makes it grace, and what is essential, its moral values.
World War I spanned 4 years and saw the deaths of some 14 million people. Despite the staggering bloodshed, many say the conflict remains misunderstood, both its causes and its lingering effects on modern geopolitics. One of these people is Priya Sathia, a professor of modern British history at Stanford University and the author of Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. Welcome to The Takeaway, Priya.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a war that claimed millions of lives. In terms of the outcome, what did this war achieve, and did the outcomes match up with the goals of the countries that were involved?
So the war absolutely transformed the world, but not in the ways that were anticipated by the players who first started it in 1914. So in 1914, a lot of the European powers who first joined the war had very nationalistic goals in mind, and it was almost sort of a test of national power and merit, right? But by the end of the war, it's about lots of other things. It's about the remaking of the Middle East. It's about a new form of global governance. It's about the loss of an entire generation. It's about the Russian Revolution and the new impetus to anti-colonial movements around the world. It's about the rise of the United States. I mean, a lot of really important outcomes emerge, but they don't neatly line up with what the players had set out to achieve.
And it was often referred to as the war to end all wars. Unfortunately, it was the First World War, which indicates we had a second. What was the war to end all wars supposed to mean?
I think once it became clear that the costs of this war were going to be really high, the human costs of it became important that, well, if we've done this, if we're doing this, it has to be a war to end all wars and a war that will settle those questions of, you know, those nationalist rivalries once and for all. But of course, ironically, it was a war that didn't really end and that produced a peace that didn't produce peace. So for the British, the war goes on well into the 1920s. It doesn't end neatly on Armistice Day.
And I'm wondering, 100 years ago, for many folks would feel completely removed from where we are today. But can you give us a sense of what some of the impact World War I had on our current geopolitical movement and other ways that it's really shaped the world that we live in?
So at a geopolitical level, a lot of the sort of conflicts and tensions and sort of the Western approach to trying to manage those tensions in the Middle East come directly from World War I, because that war was the end of the Ottoman Empire. That was the power that was kind of straddling that whole, what we call the Middle East, that area, for several centuries before. In World War I, Britain destroys the Ottoman Empire. And what comes out of it is this sort of made up, you know, nation state structure. I mean, first it's a series of colonial states, colonized states, run by the French and the British. And then it's eventually these nation states, and a lot of the borders, a lot of the kind of government structures and style, the support for authoritarian rulers in those governments, a lot of this has been shaped by British and French and American actions in the region since World War I. So geopolitically, I think that's a huge sort of legacy that we're still dealing with. Of course, beyond that, there's also the start of the League of Nations, the first attempt at creating an institution for international governance, and the heir to that is the United Nations. We had the Russian Revolution, which of course started the Cold War at a geopolitical level. Domestically also, there's so many changes. The way the British state and governments in many of the participating countries were transformed during the war, and they just developed capacities and a range that didn't go away immediately after World War I, right? This is where we have the birth of, you know, very efficient official propaganda, for instance, state management of economies, of entire economies, of people and their labor at a new level, provisions even for welfare that stay afterwards. So there's a transformation of what people expect from the state and how the state institutions operate. And in the colonies of the French Empire, the British Empire, anti-colonial movements become much, much more powerful and with a really strong following.
Priya Sethia is a professor of modern British history at Stanford University. Priya, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Veterans, we want to hear from you. What do you think of Trump's relationship with the military? What should the military's relationship with the president be?
My name is Dee Dee Franco, and I'm from Little Rock, California. As a veteran, I believe the president should stay as far away from our military as possible. He has shown no respect for the dedication, the integrity, the selflessness, nor the sacrifice inherent in military service, but instead has repeatedly shown himself to be lazy, opportunistic, and self-serving, and treats our troops as though they were disposable, existing only for his own personal and egotistical gain.
Hi, I'm Joe Alvarez. I'm calling from Shirley, Massachusetts. True humility is not thinking less of yourself, but thinking of yourself less. As a former active Army officer, I've served under many excellent commanders, and they were all humble in that way.
Hi, my name is John Cyrus. I'm calling from Deerfield Beach, Florida. I believe the relation between the president and the military should be the military's job is to defend and plan on attack, and the president's job is to be selective, and she should be using the military as a last resort.
Hi, this is Steve from Oregon. I served in the U.S. Navy from 1985 to 1989. I'm impressed with Trump's overall foreign policy. He's been successful in dealing with hostile governments by using Reagan's playbook.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. You can also join the conversation on the Takeaways Facebook page. On Sunday, President Trump spoke from the Suresnes American Cemetery in France at a ceremony marking the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended the First World War.
We are gathered together at this hallowed resting place to pay tribute to the brave Americans who gave their last breath in that mighty struggle.
But there was another memorial the president and first lady did not attend, a visit to a cemetery marking the Battle of Belleau Wood. That decision was roundly criticized and also appeared at odds with the president, who's endorsed increased military spending, asked for a military parade, and just sent thousands of troops to the U.S. southern border. So what do we make of our commander-in-chief's relationship with the armed forces? For that, we turn to a veteran. Jeffrey Korn is a retired Army lieutenant colonel who served for more than two decades in the armed forces, and he's currently a professor of law at South Texas College of Law in Houston.
Well, we know that there was a lot of news that he canceled his visit to Belleau Wood, and many of the headlines indicated it was because of rain. So my first reaction was I really hope there was a compelling reason for him not to be able to make that ceremony. That ceremony obviously had special significance this year, not only because it was the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended the fighting of World War I, but also because it happened to fall on the 243rd birthday of the United States Marine Corps. And the Marines really did fight valiantly during that war in those areas. And undoubtedly, there are many Marines that are buried at that cemetery. Personally, it perplexes me when we see these type of actions by the president, because he purports to have this incredible respect and admiration for the armed forces. And of course, nobody can get in his mind and know exactly what he feels or believes, but these type of manifestations of respect are very important. And I think that there were many veterans and service members looking at that who probably would have been first perplexed and potentially very disappointed with his failure to attend.
And we've been looking at some data to sort of put this conversation in context, Jeffrey. And there was a Military Times poll from October 2017, and that found that 44% of active duty troops had a favorable view of the president. That was compared to 36% under President Obama. 40% had an unfavorable opinion of him. And once again, these are active duty troops. The percentage of support is even higher among veterans. A Pew poll from last year found that he had a 54% job approval rating among veterans. Again, this was last year. What do you make of those numbers?
Well, I have to say, I'm actually surprised that at the 44%, I would have assumed that it was higher within the active duty force. I think that people need to understand that one of the great things about the military is you learn to kind of tune out a lot of the political noise that's going on in the country, because it's not really your role to be making these type of political judgments in terms of the performance of your duty. You obey your orders. And if you've been in the military for a long time, you've served under presidents that come from both political parties. Sometimes you vote for them, sometimes you don't. Many service members, I would assume, don't vote at all. And so in general, I think the attitude is it's noise. We do our duty. We are accountable to the civilian authorities, and whatever is happening is happening. I think that some of President Trump's campaign comments troubled many people in the military, particularly the dismissive comments about Senator McCain's wartime record and his service as a prisoner of war, or is enduring the experience of being a prisoner of war. And then some of the bombast related to bombing ISIS families and how waterboarding is nothing compared to what I'm going to do. There were probably some people in the service who found that appealing, but my belief is that most members of the service understand that it's much more complex to engage in military operations, and it's not as easy as simply saying we're just going to kill everybody and that's going to be that.
Well, and one of the things that we were most closely watching was a lot of the president's talk prior to the midterm elections about the migrants who are coming towards the United States from Central America. Whether or not that was a political stunt, there were many people who said that it was. The president still deployed thousands of troops. So far, it's about 5,000. It could go anywhere up to 15,000 to the U.S.-Mexico border. They're waiting for a caravan, a quote-unquote caravan, that may or may not even reach the border for weeks, if not months. The New York Times said that some of these troops are there. They're battling heat exhaustion and boredom. How do you explain this type of deployment in terms of cost, not just financial cost, but cost to the folks that are actually on the border, to the soldiers that are there?
I mean, I think it's a difficult question. I don't hold myself as out as an expert on the national security aspects of the use of the military domestically in terms of policy reasons. I can tell you that legally, there is a role for the active duty to play to provide support to civil authorities domestically. It's a very complex mission, a very restrictive mission because of a law called the Posse Comitatus Act. What I found troubling, and I think many people found troubling, again, was the rhetoric. The use of the term invasion, coupled with a deployment of active duty, a large number of active duty forces to the border, the comment about shooting back if somebody throws a rock. Again, nuance. I mean, if you're a soldier standing on the border and somebody picks up a chunk of concrete and begins to throw it at you, of course you have a right to defend yourself. But the perception was encouraging an over-aggressive and overzealous use of force by military members, which would have catastrophic legal policy and public perception effects. You almost have the feeling of the old saying, it's a solution in search of a problem. You know, they're putting up concertina wire, they're using helicopter assets to transport personnel and do surveillance. Are they getting some training benefit out of that? Yes, whenever you're doing an operation, you get just deploying gives you training benefit. Is it a mission that warrants a commitment of active duty forces in the same numbers that are analogous to what we have in Afghanistan right now? Personally, I think the answer is no, but the president has the prerogative to make these decisions. And if Congress acquiesces and isn't critical about these decisions, then it's going to give him the space to use the military the way he wants in this regard, so long as it's legal and what they're doing there is legal.
Jeffrey Korn is a professor of law at South Texas College of Law in Houston and a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's our show for today. But we've got one more thing for you. At a time when the news cycle can feel like pretty much one tragedy or bitter partisan fight after another, we here at The Takeaway want to let you know we feel you. So to fight back, we're launching a new project called America the Kind, and we need your help. We're looking for stories of people doing something nice for each other. That's right, nice. It could be small, maybe your neighbor cleared away the leaves in front of your house, or a barista complimented you and brightened your day. Or maybe a friend stepped up in a big way when you were going through a hard time. Or you know someone who volunteers and always goes above and beyond. Do you have a story from your community about an act of altruism? Or has somebody been just really kind or nice to you? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253 with your story. And we might feature you on the show. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or head to our website and fill out the nomination form. That's at thetakeaway.org/AmericaTheKind. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. And do me a favor, go be kind to someone.
The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, committed to providing tools to enable customers to bundle home and auto insurance. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
And Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, or German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, B-A-B-B-E-L.com.